This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
This week in our 263rd episode, we have a bunch of news, including a brand new Miragaya find, which is a much more complete skeleton than we've seen before, and a new dinosaur from Japan. We also have an interview with Joe Pegler and Corey Richards from the Erromanga Natural History Museum in Erromanga, Queensland, Australia. And we have Dinosaur of the Day, Neovenator, or Neovenator, depending on how you want to say it.
Yep, and that goes for a lot of dinosaur names.
Yep. But before we get into all that, we'd like to thank some of our patrons. And this week, we'd like to thank Kyle, Brendan Cavanaugh, the Tolbert family, Sean Tanagaki, Remy Rodriguez, Rohan, Bradley, Bilal, Avery, Crispy, Jeb from Arkansas, Albertosaurus, Trev, Ayrton and Everett, and Greg.
Yeah, thank you so much for being part of our community. We really appreciate all of the support you give us, and that's a big reason why we were able to go to Australia and see places like the Erromanga Natural History Museum. So thank you so much. And if you want to join this growing community, then check out our page at patreon.com/inodino. We offer a lot of cool rewards, such as our Discord, where you can request dinosaurs and chat with the other enthusiasts.
Yep. The Discord server is great. Jumping into the news, our first article is by Francisco Costa and Octavio Mateus, and it was published in PLOS One. It's all about the new Miragaya specimen, which was found in Portugal. So if you're familiar, Miragaya is the stegosaur with spikes instead of plates down its tail. I think it's probably the most famous stegosaur that has that kind of layout, although Kentrosaurus is also depicted fairly often with the half spikes, half plates look.
A lot of spiky stegosaurs.
There are. Yeah, they're definitely not all like stegosaurus with just plates and then a couple spikes at the end. This paper is focused on dasentrurine stegosaurs, and it's a really small group of mid and late Jurassic stegosaurs, and they include, in order of naming, Dasentrurus armatus from England, which is why they're called dasentrurine.
Gets the honor of the name.
Yeah. There's also Miragaya longicaulum, which is from Portugal. There's Alcovasaurus longispinus from Wyoming, and Adratiklet bulafa from Morocco. I want to mention quickly, too, that Stegosaurus longispinus was named in 1914, and then in 2016, it became Alcovasaurus longispinus. So that specific individual and that species was known about for a while, but it later got extracted from Stegosaurus and given its own genus. And then Adratiklet isn't mentioned at all in the paper. I think that's probably because Adratiklet was published this year, and it was probably after the paper was already written. So probably got left out for that reason. Like most stegosaurs, dasentrurine finds are pretty incomplete in general. We often don't find very complete stegosaurs, unfortunately. And Miragaya longicaulum was named based on the front half of the animal in 2009. So it was a partial head, a complete neck with some small plates on it, and front arms. And longicaulum literally means long neck. Then it was a little bit later when we found another specimen that had spikes that gave us that distinction of the spiky back half. Dasentrurus armatus was named way back in 1902. It had been Omosaurus armatus in 1875 before that, but that was kind of a pre-filled taxa, so it had to get renamed because it was already the name of something else. And because of that, Dasentrurus clearly gets the naming preference since it was named over 100 years ago and about 100 years before any other dasentrurine was named. Unlike Miragaya, which is known just from the front half, Dasentrurus at least the holotype, was mostly just the back half of the dinosaur. So people previously have proposed that Miragaia might just be Dasynturus, and we just have two different halves of the same animal and nothing overlapping, so we shouldn't have given them different names, basically. But if you jump ahead to 2009, some Miragaia-looking bones were found while updating the collection records at the National Laboratory of Energy and Geology in Portugal. These bones were labeled as the ankylosaur Dracopelta, and eventually they figured out that they were dug up in 1959. So they've been sitting there for quite a while, 60 years.
Yeah, that happens a lot, though.
It does, yeah. So now, 60 years later, we have a description. I guess it only took 50 years to actually find the bones.
Yep.
But, yeah.
Which is not as long as other bones and other descriptions.
Yeah. Yeah, they can sit in collections for a long time. If they don't look exciting and you find something else new, that just always gets priority. The key to this new find is that it has both the front and hind sections of the skeleton. And since it's from Portugal, obviously, we're already starting to assume that it's a Miragaia. And they say, quote, "This new specimen is to date the most complete dinosaur described from Portugal and the most complete stegosaur described from Europe," end quote. So it's quite a good dinosaur find and stegosaur find for Europe. It's certainly not in amazing condition, though. And that might be obvious considering it sat in a box for 50 years. If it was in great condition, someone probably would have jumped at the opportunity to prep it out a lot earlier. But it does have both hind legs, most of the tail, a partial spike and plate, some of the hips, ribs, hand slash front foot bones, a lot of the neck, and even part of the skull.
That's a good amount.
It is, but it sounds a lot better in that description than it really is, because most of the bones are pretty smashed up and a lot of them are really fragmentary. So
it would have been difficult to prepare.
Yeah, I think more like once you prepare it, the bone, none of them really look great. So it's not the kind of thing you'd expect to go on a display and everybody be in awe of, like with Borealopelta or something. It's more like it's really important scientifically because now we can compare the front and back half of the animal. As a result, they pretty definitively showed that Miragaia is a different animal than Dasynturus. So Miragaia's name appears to be safe, but they did propose synonymizing Alcovosaurus with Miragaia, although not at the species level. So before I mentioned that it's Alcovosaurus longispinus, and then there's Miragaia longicaulum. It's kind of confusing because they both have longa in it. But remember, longicaulum means long neck, whereas longispinus obviously is long spines. And the species still being distinct means that there are now just two Miragaia specimens. There's Miragaia longicaulum from Portugal and Miragaia longispinus from Wyoming.
You mean species, not specimens?
Yes. There's more than that many specimens. And this might hold up. I mean, we don't know how long it'll last in the literature. It's possible that somebody might say, well, really, we shouldn't have separated out Miragaia from Dasynturus. And based on this new find, you know, let's just combine all three into Dasynturus. But we'll just have to see how the literature settles out. But no matter what, if you call it Miragaia or Alcovosaurus longispinus, it's very similar to Miragaia longicaulum, which means that we had these similar stegosaurs in Portugal and Wyoming, both in the late Jurassic, and it shows that stegosaurs could make their way between Europe and North America in the late Jurassic pretty easily.
Interesting. Dinosaurs could really make their way around.
Yeah. I think they implied, too, that Miragaia longicaulum might be a little bit earlier, so it might show that this is the origins of the Miragaia, you know, Dasynturines on their way into North America. But obviously, we have a pretty fragmentary record at this point. And up next, we have our new dinosaur from Japan. Specifically, it's from Fukui, and this one was published by Takuya Imai and others and published in Communications Biology. And so far, there have been quite a few dinosaurs found in Fukui. Just listing the ones that are named after Fukui, we've got the Hadrosaur Fukuisaurus, the sauropod Fukui Titan, and the non-avian theropods Fukui Raptor and Fukuivenator. So there's already four Fukui somethings.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a fifth one, because there's the new flying theropod Fukui Pterix Prima. And Fukui Pterix means Fukui Wing, and Prima means primitive.
I wonder how many variations you can get.
There's a much longer list. They've already done the easiest ones with Raptor, Saurus, Titan, and Venator. I think those are probably the easiest ones.
Mm-hmm.
But then you could also have Fukui Draco or Draken for the dragon.
Oh, true.
And then in, you know, in China, they always like to do Long at the end. So it could be Fukui Long.
Yeah, yeah. It can get really confusing. You could have Fukui Saurus and Fukui Sora.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if they'd allow that. I hope they wouldn't. That'd be too much. But back to Fukui Terex. Technically, Fukui Terex is an avialin, meaning it has wings, but it may not have flown all that much. Purists might not consider it to be a bird, or maybe just call it a basal bird, but we usually just call avialins birds because they've got wings. It's generally assumed that they had some level of flight feathers and strong enough wings to actually flap them a little bit and get off the ground one way or another. But the most important thing about Fukui Terex isn't that it's just an avialin, it's that it was three-dimensionally preserved, which makes it unlike Archaeopteryx, which is essentially smashed into a 2D plane.
Yep.
I mean, everybody knows that.
That famous pose.
Yeah, where it's smashed with its wings out to its side. Obviously, it wasn't in that position while it was alive. It had to get squished pretty good to end up in that shape.
Squished pretty good.
Like a lithograph. So that's also the case for most of the feathered Chinese finds. They're also two-dimensionally smashed. And it works out for those too, because it actually helped preserve the feathers that way, because you can kind of see how they're positioned around the body. It's pretty neat. But unfortunately, that means that you can't get a lot of good definition into the sort of overall shape of the bones. You can kind of measure their length and you can see how big it was, but it's hard to get some of the detail about some of the three-dimensional characteristics of the bones that you'd be able to see with most other preservation. So Fukui Terex has this three-dimensional level going for it, but unfortunately, the bones are disarticulated. So it's not really perfectly lifelike. They're sort of scattered around and jumbled into a ball. So it still requires quite a bit of interpretation to figure out exactly how the bones would have fit together. Altogether, they found a mostly complete wing, tail, and leg, plus a few important partial bones, including a tiny bit of the jaw. Unfortunately, there are no teeth. A partial furcula, also known as the wishbone, which is important for flapping wings. Some coracoids, which are not fused to the scapula as they are in modern birds. And that's another thing that makes them a little more rigid and better at flapping. And when you combine those features, you end up with something that looks kind of like an Archaeopteryx, but without the big tail fan. Instead, it has a pygo style. So it just has a few little vertebrae that are fused together, kind of like our tailbone, but a little bit bigger.
So cute.
Yeah. Definitely more bird-like than that big, freaky, extra wing tail that Archaeopteryx and some other early dinosaur birds had. It's probably not too surprising since Fukui Terex is about 30 million years more recent than Archaeopteryx, putting it at about 120 million years old in the early Cretaceous. And they describe it as pigeon-sized. So it was pretty cute. Unfortunately, they didn't find any lags, but that probably means that it was under a year old. So that's kind of sad.
Or that it was even cuter.
Yeah, I guess. The silver lining. They do think that the growth was slowing, though, so it was likely near full size at this pigeon size. And phylogenetically, it came out just one node more derived than Archaeopteryx, meaning one more down the family tree. So it's a little bit more bird-like, perhaps, than Archaeopteryx, but it's really not that big of a change for 30 million years later. And it's just in between Archaeopteryx and Jeholornis, which is probably the most basal avialin from the Jehol biota. So either there's a huge ghost lineage between Archaeopteryx and Fukui Terex, or Archaeopteryx was just an evolutionary dead end, which seems to be what more and more people are thinking, because it's this really early bird and then we don't really see a lot else nearby for quite a while.
It's interesting because for so long it was considered the link between dinosaurs and birds.
Yeah, until we found all these really good ones in China. And then we're like, oh, this is a way better link. But it could also just be preservation because we happen to have this one area in Germany where we find all these Archaeopteryx from 150 million years ago. And then there isn't, you know, one from 140 million years ago just on the road. So who knows?
Another case of need more fossils.
Yeah. And need more quarries. Interestingly, this all makes Fuquiteryx the only early Cretaceous avialin without a rigid thorax, or to put it another way, the only non-ornithothoracine from outside northeast China. So really it was just the J-hole biota, and then you had Archaeopteryx, but that's in Europe and it's in the Jurassic. So yeah, we have a pretty scattered view of this group of animals. But fortunately, what that does mean is that this wasn't just a unique adaptation to a specific environment, because in the early Cretaceous, the Fukui area of Japan was warmer and lower lying than the J-hole area of China. So previously people have said, well, maybe there was just some sort of unique environment going on in northeast China, and that's why we have all these birds that are kind of weird and unique to the area, and all these things are popping up there. But having found this one clearly in a different environment in Japan means that we might be able to find these types of early birds popping up all over the place and not just in very specific environments. Although you definitely need a specific environment to preserve a small bird into a fossil.
Very true. Moving on to museum news, the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History in Connecticut will be doing renovations soon, and they recently had art conservators assess their iconic mural, The Age of Reptiles. So this mural is 110 feet long, 16 feet high, and they wanted to assess it before the renovations start because it's going to stay in place while they're doing everything. It will be behind scaffolding, though. So the conservators are determining if the mural has any delicate areas, although anything that's fading or any kind of paint loss will be treated after the renovations. The mural was fully restored about 10 years ago, so they don't think there's going to be anything major to report, but they want to make sure because, again, it's pretty iconic.
It is, yeah. A lot of people have seen this and maybe don't even know where Yale is because it's been redistributed all over the world in all sorts of books and magazines and videos, so I definitely knew that image before I knew where it was from. So yeah, hopefully they keep it up.
Oh yeah, they will. Don't worry. This next one is a little bit late, but we tend to record a little early. So this happened in the U.S. The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade at the end of November had a dinosaur float. So it was a T-Rex named Rexy, who's the coach mascot. And Rexy was on a float called Rexy in the City, and that's inspired by the city of New York, so that's where the parade takes place. And I only saw one picture. It looked like there was a lot of glitter involved.
Oh, really? What color was it?
I don't know. It's a picture of a picture. So it's a picture of their design that I saw. A whole bunch of different colors, but very glittery.
Rainbow dinosaur.
And sticking with the holiday spirit, the American Museum of Natural History, also in New York, recently put up a nearly 13-foot, 4-meter tall tree that's decorated with more than 800 origami dinosaurs.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's too bad we won't make it to New York in time. But the museum, apparently every year since the 1970s, has been lighting up their tree that's decorated with some kind of origami thing that's related to the collections, and the theme this year is T-Rex and Friends: History in the Making. Some of the origami was donated by professional artists. Most of it was made by the people who designed the tree, Ross Joyce and Talo Kawasaki, as well as volunteers from Origami USA. And about a quarter of the 800 pieces were new. The rest had, I guess, been on the tree before. Seems like they would have dinosaurs fitting into multiple themes, so that makes sense. Based on the pictures, it looks like they have hatchlings, T-Rex, Parasaurolophus, and some other prehistoric animals such as a mammoth. These get really intricate. I have no idea how. I can't do anything with origami. But anyway, for anyone in New York, the tree will be on display at the first floor Grand Gallery until January 12th, so you have a few weeks to enjoy it.
So according to the AM&H, a mammoth is a friend of a T-Rex, if it's T-Rex and Friends?
It's history in the making. So, you know, mammoths came after T-Rex as part of the history making.
Oh, I see.
That's what I'm going to go with.
Good. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. Treat yourself or a loved one to a lifetime of language learning. There are a lot of dinosaur hotspots in the world, and high on our list of places to visit is Brazil because there are so many cool dinosaur sites in that country.
Yes, it's home to some of the earliest dinosaurs, like Saturnalia, a small long-necked dinosaur that weighed just a little more than a house cat. And then there's Ostroposeidon, the largest known dinosaur from Brazil. It's about 82 feet or 25 meters long. And the carnivorous Thanos. Yes, that Thanos, named for the Marvel Comics supervillain. Plus, some really amazing sites like the one recently described where people from thousands of years ago made rock carvings to go alongside dinosaur tracks.
Yeah, petroglyphs and footprints in one place.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely want to learn Portuguese before we visit Brazil. One thing we've learned from our travels is you have a lot more fun adventures when you know the local language.
Yeah, and places like petroglyphs aren't always near big cities, so it's very useful to have some local language knowledge. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in handy. It's designed and refined by language learning experts, and the lessons are immersive. There's also an audio companion, which is great when you're commuting, taking long walks, or even doing chores around the house.
Perfect for when you're waiting for the next Dino episode to drop. So, saúde, or cheers. Join now at rosettastone.com/dino for a special limited time offer just for our listeners, and you'll get over 50% off for a lifetime membership. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and you'll get access to all 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now we're going to go on to our interview, which we recorded in Aromanga. Aromanga was actually the inspiration for our dinosaur road trip. They invited us to come out to their museum. Before we had planned any of this stuff, we were just going to go out there for SVP, maybe swing by Sydney or something, and then we got invited to the middle of the outback, so we decided, well, as long as we're doing that, it's like a 2-day drive from any major city, so we might as well drive through some other dinosaur sites.
Yeah, and it wasn't a bad drive either. It was a lot of fun.
It was. A lot of the road there was a single lane, which is kind of weird. I mean, like a single lane total for both directions. So when a car was coming the other way, you have to kind of pull halfway off the road or all the way off the road, depending on how big they are, which was a little bit weird.
Yeah, but if you're used to driving on the other side of the road, that makes it easier.
It does, yeah. There's no mistakes to make.
Yeah.
And I think that was mostly because we came from the northern route. Like, we came from Winton down to Aramanga. But once we got to Aramanga and we started heading east, which is the way you'd go from most major cities, it was a little bit easier.
It's a really fun drive. Also great for listening to audiobooks.
Yeah, it was. And it's the kind of stuff that you don't see unless you go out there. So we really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Plus the number of birds that we saw on the drive.
Yeah. And other wildlife and termite mounds all filling up fields.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really amazing.
But without further ado, we're going to go on to our interview with Joe Pegler and Corey Richards. We are joined this week by Joe Pegler, who is the laboratory coordinator, and Corey Richards, who's the operations and marketing coordinator, both at the Aromanga Natural History Museum here in Southwest Queensland. Thank you both for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having us.
Awesome. So what was the original impetus for starting this museum? Start way back at the beginning, if we can.
Okay. Well, 1998. There was a visit to this area by Paul Serino, along with Queensland Museum Ralph Molnar, Dr. Ralph Molnar, Joanne Wilkinson, and they came out just to really investigate this area to see if it was the right area, to look at the geological features and see if there could be dinosaurs in this area. And that was the beginning of the awareness that there could be dinosaurs out here. So following that in 2004, the landholders on that property where they did visit found dinosaur fossils. So that was the beginning of this journey of Erromanga Natural History Museum.
Awesome.
And you've been involved since basically the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. It's been pretty amazing to have been a neighbour of theirs, of the property where they were found, and started off being trained as a fossil preparator. So that's where my passion is, preparing the fossils. So it's been an amazing journey.
Was the work around here your first work with fossils, or had you done it previously?
Yeah, no, nothing at all. So we live on a property with sheep and cattle and an interest in natural history, but nothing to do with dinosaurs. So it was, it's been an amazing learning experience, yeah.
But now you're, what, 10, 15, 20 years in?
Yeah, 15 almost 16 years in, and yeah, it's great to be involved in the whole process of building this museum.
Awesome. And the museum itself was built how long ago?
We opened to the public 2016, but built 2015. So it was a pretty big move from our field station, which was on the property where we found the bones. So we had to bring everything in using tractors, cars, and obviously bringing the really fragile... The pelvis and everything was pretty thin, wasn't it? Mm. But from there, we've been open, 4 years to the public, and we're kind of about to go into our fifth year and new development, which is pretty exciting.
Right. What in the next year, right? There's going to be new buildings, new lots of things.
Yeah, so we received funding federally and state and our local council as well, which is pretty cool. And so hopefully we've just got the tenders back, but we will be able to have new visitor service facilities, a theatre, some extra little bit of exhibition space, but then it'll all hopefully link in and be able to help us have more people through, which will be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Should also mention too, we've got 2/3 of the crew wear multiple hats.
Yes, we're missing Robin, aren't we? She's our general manager in collections. So she also wears multiple hats. But yeah, we only have a staff of 3 currently running the museum. We do have seasonal staff, which help us out quite a lot, but it's a pretty big job trying to run the museum, especially with our accommodation and also all of the fossils that have to be preserved. Yeah.
Do you get a lot of people staying? I mean, I know you opened this hotel, what, just a year ago?
Yeah, so it has been, it's another great string to the bow, really, that it's another income stream, and it's great for people who visit the museum and maybe want to come and learn, do the prep experience. They might do 10 days and stay at the museum. It's also another accommodation option for people in the area. So we've got a really rich gas and oil resources out here. So it's also another accommodation option for them.
Because there's only one other hotel in the city, right?
Yes. We have the 1885 Royal Hotel in Erromanga, and then the Erromanga Motel. So.
The 2017.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, for a town of 40-odd people, it's enough.
So one of the big kind of claims to fame, I think, would be Cooper, right? Can you tell us a little bit about Cooper?
So, well, Cooper is Australia's largest dinosaur. So he's 30 metres long and 6.5 metres tall to the hip. So he is pretty big. We find the fossils only 1.5 hours west of the museum. So that's kind of why the museum is where it is. But yeah, we've got about between 10 and 14% of the dinosaur, but he really is what brings us the most people. People want to see Australia's largest dinosaur instead of seeing some of our smaller but still very interesting dinosaurs as well. Yeah, he's pretty cool. He's pretty big too. So trying to build a place that can actually fit that dinosaur in is kind of challenging.
Sure. Yeah.
I can imagine, because Cooper is what kind of sauropod is he?
Well, he's a titanosaur, still undescribed. We had an abstract released. We actually had 2 abstracts released at SVP, which was pretty exciting. So this is our emerging paper for the museum. We're pretty excited because it means that hopefully it'll attract some more scientific involvement and, yeah, more interest, especially internationally and also in Australia.
What's the story behind Cooper's nickname?
So Cooper refers to the area he's from so the Cooper Basin. Cooper's Creek runs through that area. So, yeah, that's how he ended up with his nickname, to give him a locality name.
So we also have, what, Zach, Tom, Sid. Zach was found on Anzac Day, which is an Australian holiday for our Australian and New Zealand service people. Tom was found after the young boy who found the first bones. Monty is named after he's actually named after landholders' dogs. The story goes that someone asked, how did these large titanosaurs walk? And someone said, Monty walked along at the site, very senile, as he was 14 or so. And the paleontologist said, not unlike Monty. So, you know, gives a good indication about the names. They really are colloquial, yeah.
And Corey, you worked on Cooper back in the day?
Well, I actually went to Cooper's Dig when I was actually 12, so pretty small. I got to go with my grandparents and see it all happening when it was all really a hive down in the southwest corner. I think Jo actually probably remembers it better than me, because she not only dug all the time, but she also prepped the Cooper's fossils, getting them ready for the announcement in 2007, which was pretty cool.
So I cut my teeth, as you say, learning how to prep the bones on Cooper. We were all trained by Queensland Museum staff, geosciences staff and preparators. So Joe Wilkinson predominantly showed us how to prep these dinosaurs out. Cooper was found just in clay. So he has a really mosaic appearance. He was really fragile, which, you know, had a few challenges, but it was probably really good material to learn on, to be really careful and think about that conservation.
Yeah, I think anyone who was at SVP would have seen Jo's handiwork with all of her cradling and everything, which was pretty cool. But Jo taught me how to prep as well, and also Robin, but we, our team of three seems to be able to work through a lot of the material. It takes us a fair while. We're slowly getting more volunteers, more programs, but yeah, you know, starting a museum, there is no actual guidebook on doing it, but yeah. Not many people get to say, we started a museum, do they? No.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah. Was the, when you were doing the early prep work on Cooper, was that around here?
So in the early years, we had a field station on the property where Cooper was found, because there was no facility to do it. So the landowners set up, actually built a building, and we set up a field lab. So that was pretty good. I live probably an hour from there, so it was a matter of going out on weekends and spending time, but it was where Robin could go and prep each day. So that was the early years, probably right up until 2015. All the work was done out there until we had a facility in Aramanga. So, yeah, a lot of work happened there. And there was lots of volunteers over that time, some from Queensland Museum and just some locals who were interested in learning to prep. So they generously gave their time.
Awesome.
It's kind of interesting that probably, yeah, I think it'd be confident to say that 90% of Cooper's holotype specimen was prepped in a tin shed. It was only about 6x6, really. So I guess the significance doesn't change as long as it gets done, hey?
That's great.
And so the Aramanga Museum also has megafauna, right?
Yeah, so our megafauna is late Pleistocene. It's around 100,000 years old. So we work on diprotodons, so the large marsupial bears, backwards facing pouch joey that weighed up to around 70 kilos, and megalania. We also work on bits and pieces of procoptodon, but pretty well anything. It's quite an interesting emerging field, because we find it is a clay, it's a fluvial deposit again, and these mud springs is what brought the animals to them. They're now extinct, but the diprotodons and megafauna pretty well were looking for moisture because it was so dry at that period. Yeah, they're pretty cool though. They're if you've ever kind of thought of what a dig, and it's probably a bit more archaeological digging those guys out, because a dinosaur dig can be pretty heavy and hefty. We use tractors a lot, whereas it's all, the megafauna is a lot of just small probe work in the clay. It's almost perfect, really.
Nice.
So at the museum, you do tours four times a day. What can visitors expect to see or do?
So we start off with a bit of a presentation talking about the geological history of the area, talking about the reign of dinosaurs and then the extinction, then leading on to the emergence of megafauna. So we sort of set the scene and give people a bit of a backstory first, and then we go through our labs, our megafauna lab and our dinosaur lab, look at our material, how we prep it out. And then we finish by going into the holotype room and showing them the type specimens of Cooper and other dinosaurs we have in the collection.
Yeah, that's the cool part.
Yeah, that's great. Do you guys have a lot of material that you're prepping right now?
Yes, there is so much. So between the dinosaurs and megafauna, we've got kind of like over 80 sites, which is a lot.
Wow. Yeah.
For us. And it takes us about 4 years on average to prep every site. So we've now filled up the museum. we're now out on the Skillion, and I think the next dig will probably include going back into the old holotype collection room, which was just a big refrigerated container. So until we start, I think we're pretty well due for our next stage, trying to get a bit more space, free up a bit more room. And yeah, there is a lot to do, but it's quite mesmerizing looking back at all of those jackets and thinking, well, that one came out in 2008, that one came out in 2012. But it's all about priorities, I guess. Yeah.
So how do you decide which thing you want to prep next?
Joe?
So largely, I think that's led by our researchers. So Scott Hucknall at the Queensland Museum is a paleontologist with the project, and it depends on if we open a new site, something might turn up there that he feels needs investigation. So we might skip a particular site and start working on new material to build that picture of what's happening out here in the southwest.
Cool. So
anyone who was at SVP probably saw, who came over to our stall, would have, our booth, I guess you call it, would have seen our the tail from Zach, which was starting to get prepped out. That's a bit of a priority at the moment, but we're currently digging a dinosaur called Monty, which I talked about before. But Monty, a lot of the bones that we're pulling out from this site comparatively actually seem to be even bigger than Cooper. So preliminary, we're pretty excited. There's no confirmed size difference, but it's at least 5 to 10% bigger, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
So we're super keen to get that out. We just have to, you know, keep prepping. It seems like hopefully every time we dig something more, they get bigger, they mm-hmm. get more exciting. So there's talks maybe we might start a new site next year, or we'll keep going with Monty. We're not 100% sure, but I think whatever it'll be pretty cool.
Awesome. Yeah, 30 meters is getting up there. They don't get too much bigger than that.
No.
Maybe another 10 meters or so.
Well, yeah, Cooper's in the top 10 at the moment.
Yeah.
So who knows? It'd be nice to give the Patagonians and the South Americans a bit of a run mm-hmm. for their money, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Why do they get all have all the fun, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, all respect.
So is Scott the one who's going to be publishing eventually on Cooper?
Yes, he will be, yeah. So Scott is currently doing that paper. We also have a joint paper. There were two abstracts released at SVP, I'm sure you heard. The other one is more about the geology of the Winton Formation. So there's a lot to be learnt about the formation where these dinosaurs are being found. It all helps build the story of how these dinosaurs lived and died, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and you guys are like in a good spot for the Winton Formation and don't have a lot of competition nearby either for dig sites.
No, we were talking about this before, yeah, like 8 hours until our closest museum is a fair way. So, yeah, there's we've got enough space to explore without too much worry, I think. But yeah, someone was saying it's a bit like the Morrison Formation 100 years ago. Everyone trying to figure out where they belong in it. So I guess we're starting to figure out where we belong in it. And yeah, not too many people. There's only really two or three different places that are actually digging in this formation, trying to find stuff. So it's pretty cool. Every new discovery seems to have some sort of significance. So we're pretty excited.
Absolutely. Are there any dinosaurs you've found so far other than sauropods?
No, not so far. We do have a chelid. So we've got a turtle, which is pretty cool. And he is late Cretaceous. So pretty old. We're looking more into that. But no, only sauropods so far. But we
except
do...
in the trackways.
Yeah.
So there's evidence of other dinosaur species and a different trackway in the Quilby Shire, which will have more research done on it in time, I guess.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you mostly find your dinosaur bones the same way they do up by Age of Dinosaurs Museum, where like a sheep trips over it or a farmer kicks it and then notices that rock looks funny kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a similar process. Yeah, it'll just be someone out mustering, or it really is just the other day Robin was out doing some water runs and looked over her shoulder and she thought that it was cow patties, went back and there was three dorsal verts sitting on the on the surface, and then bam, it's a new site. So they aren't hard to find. They've just got to be discovered.
And you have to kind of know what you're looking for.
Yeah, well, the region we're working in is like, so they're kind of associated to the Mount Howard anticline. So this anticline's pulling the bones from about 2 meters below up to the surface. And then the self-mulching black soil picks them up and works them up. And then that's where we're finding those surface bones. And that whole area is about 80 kilometers long. So it's a fair region to be finding fossils. So we have quite a few different fields with multiple, different localities within those fields, yeah.
So that process is really different than the way we dig up bones in the US. Could you tell us a little about how that whole self-mulching soil works? It's crazy to me.
Yeah, well, I guess we rely on the soils a lot, don't we?
And the good thing, if there's any good thing to come out of a drought, is the lack of vegetation on the ground. So it does make finding dinosaur sites much easier. That would be the one positive I could think of about, drought seasons. But it does make finding these sites a lot more obvious. And they're still finding more every all the time. It's just a matter of covering the country because it is a huge area. It's finding new sites as you cover a different bit of country than you did last month.
And I guess it comes down to every time it rains, the way the self-mulching black soil works is the drying causes cracks, and then the wetting causes the moistening of the soil causes that to then contract again. So it's just picking it up. So that bone bed or those bones that were sitting below the surface may only be one wet event off the surface. So yeah, we put fence posts in the ground around here, and you might come back after a big rain event and that fence post will be pushed out. So same sort of situation with the bones, I think.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you put them in the side of a cliff, would they just push back out again or not?
So once you find, say, these three vertebrae sticking up on the surface of the soil, do you just have to dig down into soil, or do you have to go into rock now below the soil to get the dinosaur up?
So every site seems to be a little bit different. Preservation. Cooper was found just in clay, there was no rock at his site at all. The majority of the other sites have been in a concretion of rock. Some of the bones have been complete in that concretion. Some of them, like Monty, the bones are very fragmentary in that concretion, but after prepping them out, they do click back together.
Hmm.
So it's really, each site is very different. Even going to Sid, who's found in a trample zone, he's obviously been a dinosaur that's died in an area where these titanosaurs have been walking, his bones have been crushed, and then he's been preserved in that trample zone. So that they do seem to be quite differently preserved, even within a kilometre distance. So Cooper and Zach, for instance, we're within about a kilometre of each other.
Wow.
So it all presents different challenges. Monty, the site we're working on at the moment, it's a matter of dismantling that concretion, finding natural breaks in the rock and jacketing those, removing those. And, as marking everything so once you prep them out, you can then join those bones back together again.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think taphonomists could probably eat their heart out trying to figure out what's happening throughout these bones, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Have we missed it? Is there anything else about the museum that visitors or our listeners should know about?
Yeah, just that we do offer programs where members of the public can come and have an experience of working on these bones, be it megafauna or dinosaurs. They can spend a day or as many days as they like, just experiencing what it's like to expose a fossil for the first time in, you know, be it 95 million years or 100,000 years old.
That even can, we do the same sort of thing with the digs as well, which is pretty cool. We do two-week digs a year, 2 weeks of the dinosaurs in May traditionally and 2 weeks of the megafauna in August. And we take 6 people a week on our digs with us, and that seems to work really well. It's a small group and we really bond and we get a lot done, which is really cool. So we really look at involving the public in our discoveries, because it really is generational work that makes us, and it's that, I guess it's that interest and intrinsic value of what we're doing keeps us going. So yeah.
And May and August are the cooler months here.
Much cooler. Yes, I think if you were trying to dig in the middle of summer when it's like 53 degrees centigrade, it'd be pretty rough, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, everyone would have heat stroke, and I think we'd have the flying doctor out pretty regularly. So yeah, maybe a no.
So for our listeners who may not be familiar with your museum yet, where is the best place for them to find out more information?
So online, we have a website, which is www.enhm.com.au, and that will give you any amount of information that you need to know. But yeah, we'd love people to contact us if they wanted to know more. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If anyone wants to see what we're up to, we try and put a bit of information out there about what we're about.
And even if you've got some questions, don't hesitate to give us a bell. It's always exciting to see when anyone from the general public or anyone is interested to see what we're doing. So yeah,
awesome.
Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
No, thank you so much for having us.
We really appreciate you coming all the way out here. It's phenomenal, really. It's an amazing effort. Thank you very much.
Thanks again, Joe and Corey. We had a really great time seeing Aramanga and all of the collections. And we also had a lovely dinner with those two. We did the interview and then we had dinner, because there is a really great kitchen that's part of Cooper's Lodge, which is part of the museum.
Yeah, and it's a nice place to stay too.
Yeah, I definitely recommend that. The night sky was amazing. Garrett got a time lapse of all the stars.
Yeah, I love a good time lapse, and that was a good one.
Yeah, we included that in our Adventures in Australia video about the Aramanga Natural History Museum. So if you want to see it, check that out on YouTube.
This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Konglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is, if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners. And you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Neovenator, or Neovenator, depending on your preference, which was a request from Neovenator via Patreon in our Discord, so thank you.
Yeah, it's a pretty good name choice, Neovenator, if you like Neovenator.
So Neovenator was an allosauroid that lived in the early Cretaceous in what is now the Isle of Wight in the UK, and it's estimated to be about 25 feet or 7.6 meters long. It weighed about 2,200 to 4,400 pounds, about 1 to 2,000 kilograms, and it had a gracile build. It was probably an apex predator. Neovenator had 5 teeth in its premaxilla. It also had a nostril that was twice as long as high, though other theropods also had large nostrils. Neovenator may have had a sensitive face, as described by Chris Barker and others in 2017. It had this complex system of neurovascular canals, which worked like sensory organs, a similar trait to Spinosauridae, though it probably didn't look for prey in the water like dinosaurs in Spinosauridae. Neovenator may have used its complex system of neurovascular canals to be more sensitive to pressure and temperature, to control the jaw pressure, and for feeding, basically avoid biting into bone while eating.
Oof.
It's a good thing to have. They may have also used it for courtship or nurturing their young, like many modern crocodilians. But we need more analysis to understand this facial sensitivity. Neovenator fossils were found in 1978 when a storm caused rocks to fall to the beach on the Isle of Wight. And then these rocks were collected by the Henwood family and then geology student David Richards, who sent them to the Museum of Isle of Wight Geology and the British Museum of Natural History, where Alan Jack Cherig found the fossils belonged to iguanodon and some type of theropod. And the iguanodon was later referred to Mentellosaurus. And then the theropod, of course, later became known as Neovenator. In the 1980s, the British Museum of Natural History sent a team to collect more bones, and they found another theropod, tail vertebra. Amateur paleontologists started searching, too, and a lot of fossils were found. They found snout, teeth, part of the lower jaw, most of the vertebral column, ribs, chevrons, hind limbs, and more. And that was about 70% of the skeleton.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and then more individuals were found. So they were thought to be a new species of Megalosaurus, but Steve Hutt in 1990 suggested, maybe not. So in 1996, Hutt, David Martell, and Michael Barker named and described the type species Neovenator solarii, and the genus name means new hunter. The species name is in honor of the Solero family, who owned the site where it was found. Too many people had found the fossil, so they didn't want to name just one person as the one who discovered the dinosaur. Steve Brusati, Roger Benson, and Steve Hutt then re-described Neovenator in 2008. Teeth that look the same as the holotype of Neovenator were found in France in 2014. The holotype of Neovenator also had pathologies, heel fractures, vertebrae fusions, and more. Neovenator lived among fish, amphibians, lizards, pterosaurs, and then, of course, Mentellosaurus.
Very cool. And our fun fact of the day is that herbivores often specialize on specific plants. For example, diplodocids definitely couldn't eat grass. It hadn't evolved when they were around, but even if it had, their teeth would have been pretty useless for biting it. Sauropods instead would have been mostly foliovores, which means that they ate leaves. And then other herbivorous dinosaurs could be more specifically categorized, such as some Mesozoic avialins were probably frugivores or granivores, meaning that they ate fruit or seeds, because we've seen seeds in their stomach. It's also been proposed that some late Cretaceous herbivores may have been partially anthophagous, meaning that they ate flowers, and that might have directly affected the evolution of early flowers. That one's pretty speculative. I don't know if it belongs in a fun fact, but it's fun to say anyway. And then hadrosaurs have famously been found eating wood, which makes them xylophagous. And Karen Chin pointed out that they couldn't fully digest wood, so they probably weren't eating it like a lot of, you know, insects and fungus do, but instead they were probably eating those insects and fungus that were in the wood. And just
easier to just bite it off in one chunk.
Exactly. They didn't have opposable thumbs, so just chomp it down. Their teeth were getting replaced, what, every month? So just bite through the wood. Who cares? They'll wear out, but you'll get a new set of teeth and you'll get all the fungus and your gut all sorted out.
And some splinters.
Yeah, I'm sure. But because no one knows any of these terms, and I'm certainly not going to remember to say foliovore, we're just going to keep calling sauropods herbivores.
You might randomly remember. Yeah. Just throw it in every now and again.
Kind of like when I remember to say Erictodromius burrow rather than rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And if you want to join our growing community and join the conversations with fellow dinosaur enthusiasts, check out our page at patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.
Around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.